This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about the recent abolition of the death penalty in the state of Illinois.
What we thought was impossible 15 years ago now seems to be part of a growing trend. In a few years, we may not have a death penalty in the United States.
Why won't Trader Joe's pay a penny more a pound for tomatoes?
We'll hear from demonstrators in front of Trader Joe's in New York who are on a nationwide tour protesting stores that refuse to pay the extra penny, the Immokalee workers.
There's been a great people's movement to protest ongoing natural gas drilling and hydraulic fracturing of the Marcellus Shale.
Hydrofracking is killing our water supply, and the governments and oil companies don't seem to care.
Stay with us.
Michael, I wanted to ask you about Bradley Manning, who we know is being held in a marine brig. I think the right word is torture. When the State Department was asked to comment on it, there were a lot of repercussions. What do you think's going on there?
We've covered Bradley Manning's case a number of times on our radio show. And, of course, the latest concerns the conditions in which he's being held at Quantico. There's a few other people in the prison, very bad conditions, stripped naked, had to stand at attention while he was naked.
Daily.
And then they finally gave him a smock. And he's also in maximum security. And there's many claims here, including his lawyer has filed what's called an Article 138 to say he should be in medium security, not maximum. There's no reason. The psychologists have said he's really not suicidal at all. But just remember, he's a 23-year-old young man who's accused of giving some of the material through various means to WikiLeaks. And so they're treating him, obviously, very, very harshly. And it's caused a huge amount of complaint. And then the State Department spokesperson, that's like their press flack, a guy named P.J. Crawley, was speaking to a small group of people at MIT, and he was discussing new media, things like, you know, Twitter and all that stuff, and American foreign policy. And then toward the end of the talk, I guess, he was at MIT just giving a small talk to 20 people, a student or a graduate student or somebody at the talk named Charlie Dattar said as follows. There's an elephant in the room during this discussion, WikiLeaks. The U.S. government is torturing a whistleblower in prison right now. How do we resolve a conversation about the future of new media in diplomacy with the government's actions regarding WikiLeaks? Now, the answer you would have expected from the State Department spokesperson, because these are all State Department cables that have been coming out, you expected a harsh answer saying, what are you talking about? This guy basically gave up thousands and thousands of diplomatic cables. What the heck is he doing? Yes, his conditions may be harsh, but there's a suicide thing. There's all this stuff. You would have expected an excuse. But PJC, as it says, what is P.J. Crawley said? Quote, at least quote from notes that were taken, and he didn't deny it. Quote, I spent 26 years in the Air Force. What is happening to Manning is ridiculous, counterproductive, and stupid. And I don't know why the Department of Defense is doing it. He then asked, so that's his statement about Bradley Manning, the State Department spokesperson. He is then asked by the man who took the notes, he said, is that on the record? And P.J. Crawley must have really been angry because he says, yes, it's on the record. And then a day later, he resigns from the State Department and he issues a statement, again, essentially reaffirming what he thinks about the conditions under which Bradley Manning is being held. That's giant in the world to have happened for Bradley Manning. Michael?
Well, he wasn't resigned. He was fired, and he was fired by Obama. And the question that was asked, why is the Department of Defense doing it? I'd be interested in your answer, Michael. My own opinion is that, one, is they want to break him. They've had him for months and months and months under these horrible conditions. Secondly, if they break him, he's going to be unable to defend himself. And third, and I think this is the main reason, is that they want him to implicate Julian Assange. And they haven't been able to get him to do that yet, even though it's been many months. But that's why they're doing this to him.
So when you say break him, you mean break him just psychologically?
Yeah. I mean, you're in solitary confinement naked for 6 months. Eventually, your mind disintegrates. They know that.
Right. What's not clear is what he knows or whether he knows anything about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. I mean, you know, WikiLeaks had a website. You could download onto that website. It's not clear, but the government doesn't really know, and they apparently are having a rough time with figuring out anything to do with Julian Assange and others. So I agree with you. It may be as a way of getting him to confess to something or implicate other people, whether true or false, in some way. And also, I think there's just spite. There's just the issue here is this is a soldier who had access to classified material, and he violates, according to the military, that access to classified material because, if you read some of the stuff that's been written around, because he was so angry at what was happening and the cover-ups that were going on in Afghanistan and Iraq. And he took a political stand, and they're really angry, and they're not going to give him anything because they are really angry. So I think that's also part of it. So it's all of that, I think, Michael. I do think that they're trying to break him psychologically. They're trying to get him to implicate others. And they're also just angry. Then, of course, after the P.J. Crawley incident, I mean, I couldn't believe how excited I was. You know, I've been working, you know, just along the sides on the Bradley Manning issue just because it makes me so angry. And all of a sudden, you get this guy coming out of the State Department out of the blue. There he is. And, of course, people ask, why did Crawley do this? And, of course, he's right. It's counterproductive. What are they doing it for? But it also, apparently one little blog said his father was in a prisoner of war camp. The idea that you would treat people like this was just anathema to him. But in any case, a day later, there's a press conference, or 2 days later, after Crawley says this, and President Obama is asked about Bradley Manning. He's asked by one of the reporters, and usually they don't do that kind of thing. I mean, it's canned press conferences where these guys don't.
Yeah, you don't put the president on the spot and remain in your front row seat.
So here's what the president says. With respect to Private Manning, I have actually asked the Pentagon. Oh, my. He actually asked. He didn't just pretend
to ask.
I've actually asked the Pentagon whether or not the procedures that have been taken in terms of his confinement are appropriate and are meeting our basic standards. Well, it depends on what your basic standards are, Mr. President. Are they the standards of George Bush on Guantanamo? Are they the standards at communication management units in Terre Haute, Indiana, where the center just filed a lawsuit? If those are the standards, then conceivably the answer the president got, which is as follows, they assure me that they are, that the procedures are meeting our basic standards. And then the president goes on, I can't go into details about some of their concerns, but some of this has to do with Private Manning's safety as well.
Sure.
So going into the old suicide watch excuse. And if you want to hear Obama saying what I just read, here it is.
With respect to Private Manning, I have actually asked the Pentagon whether or not the procedures that have been taken in terms of his confinement are appropriate and are meeting our basic standards. They assure me that they are. I can't go into details about some of their concerns, but some of this has to do with Private Manning's safety as well. I think I gave you an answer to the substantive issue.
So there you see the president, and of course his answer has been made totally fun of by commentators. Glenn Greenwald said, well, that's very, very assuring, Mr. President. I have no doubt that George Bush asked the DOD whether everything was being run professionally at Guantanamo, and they assured him that they were. Perhaps the reason there haven't been any Wall Street prosecutions is because Obama asked Jamie Dimon and Lloyd Blankfein if there was any fraud, and those banking executives assured the president that there wasn't. Well, there you go. I mean, the president stood in front of this country, and after his own State Department spokesperson said, this is shameful, the president says, everything is A-OK with Bradley Manning.
He promised to close down Guantanamo, and he hasn't. He promised to end torture, and it's still going on. And if there's any proof of the continuity between Bush and Obama, this is it.
I do want to, as we close this little update on Bradley Manning, mention again the Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuit, Aref versus Eric Holder, and it's about President Obama essentially authorizing two worse than maximum security prisons in the United States, in Indiana and Illinois. They were begun first in secrecy by George Bush, but now they've been continued by President Obama. They're called the communications management units at those prisons. And of course, they're special prisons where people essentially aren't allowed to communicate outside. They have no contact visits. I mean, they're really bad places. And the center filed a lawsuit saying, what is this? They were originally set up only for Muslims.
Right.
But once we started litigating it, they started to move other people in there who have nothing to do with anything. I mean, everything from animal rights people to just people who they want to make the population not just look like it's all Muslim. Well, we have that lawsuit pending. Nat Hentoff just wrote a great column called King Obama's Gitmo-Style Prisons at Home, saying, I missed the coronation of President Obama where he can do all this stuff without telling anybody. Just go ahead and do it. So don't think that Private Manning is alone out there. We have a very pervasive problem of solitary confinement, communications management unit, and very nasty treatment of people who are in prison.
Last week, Governor Pat Quinn of Illinois signed into law SB 3539, which repeals the death penalty in that state. This development is yet another in what appears to signal a trend of moving away from capital punishment. Early last year, we covered the American Law Institute's declaration that the death penalty in this country has been a failure. Listeners may recall that the ALI created the intellectual framework and justification for the current capital justice system. The movement away from this most final form of punishment seems to be due in large part to the public's increased awareness about its inherent flaws, such as great racial disparity on who gets executed and for what reason. Publicity around exonerations stemming from DNA evidence has also added to general awareness of procedural errors in the system. We're joined today by Charles Hoffman, a state public defender who handles death penalty appeals before the Illinois Supreme Court. Charles, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Well, many of us were excited to learn about Law SB 3539, which repeals the death penalty in Illinois. Can you give us a bit of background leading up to this? We're all familiar with Governor Ryan's brave development years ago.
Right.
What's happened since then?
Well, as you mentioned, in 2003, Governor Ryan cleared out death row. He granted blanket clemency to the 167 men and women on death row, and he pardoned four on the basis of innocence. That prompted the Illinois legislature to pass a modicum of reform, just a few. What the governor did after he cleared out death row was establish a commission which recommended 85 reforms, and our legislature passed five or six.
I remember when he cleared out death row and why he did that, you may want to mention to us. But the commission, I remember you had that famous novelist on the commission. What's his name? Scott Turow?
Scott Turow was one of the members of the commission.
And he was pro-death penalty when he went on the commission. Is that right?
He was. And he actually wrote a little book. I think it was his second venture into nonfiction after One Hell, in which he talked about his journey from being a death penalty supporter to an abolitionist, and I think it exemplifies the journey that a lot of people take, actually that our current governor took in order to sign the bill.
You had the commission, then you said they had 85 reforms, and they passed
right.
Five of them, and then what happened?
Well, the legislature also established a death penalty reform study commission that over the past 5 years studied the effects of the reforms. And it came to the conclusion that while the reforms did improve the system, it obviously didn't make it perfect. As a matter of fact, one of the most incredible things that happened here was one of the reforms was that all confessions in police custody had to be videotaped in murder cases. And that was obviously a result of, you know, the scandal we had here with the police torture cases under former Chicago Commander John Burge, who actually is starting his prison sentence today.
Good news.
For lying to a federal court. Absolutely, very good news. But anyway, one of the reforms was that videotaping of confessions in murder cases. And everybody thought, that's great. Now there won't be any false confessions or coerced confessions. And as it turned out, just a couple years ago, two men, Jerry Hobbs and Kevin Fox, in a county north of Chicago, both confessed to the horrific murders of their own daughters. And thanks to the miracle of DNA, it was found out that their confessions were, in fact, false.
That's amazing.
It shows that no matter what safeguards you implement, there's no system that can prevent the conviction and condemning of an innocent person. That happened a couple years ago, which gave momentum to the movement to finally accept the fact that our death penalty system, like all death penalty systems, was simply too flawed to fix. And we had a couple very brave legislators in the House and Senate who led the fight, Representative Karen Yarbrough in our House and Senator Kwame Raoul in our state Senate. And they passed the abolition bill in January, which not only abolished the death penalty, but transferred all the millions of dollars that we waste trying to send people to death row and transferred that to a victim support fund. Prosecutors pay a lot of lip service to victims in homicide cases, but this actually is going to do something positive for them.
Charles, I was going to ask about the fiscal component. Was the financial part of this a part of the commission's recommendations or findings?
One thing the Death Penalty Study Reform Commission found was that one of the other reforms was transferring the cost of death penalty prosecutions from local counties, which would obviously go bankrupt, especially the small counties in Illinois in pursuing capital cases, and transferring it to a state fund. And what the commission found was that prosecutors around the state were asking for the death penalty in cases that really weren't death penalty prosecutions, just so the state would bear the cost rather than the county. It was really an abuse of the fund.
Wow, that's a nasty piece of business, I'll tell you that.
You know, it's the law of unintended consequences.
Right.
They also found that a couple defense lawyers were really overbilling the fund. I mean, it's just human nature. And so the fiscal component did play a role in that the Capital Litigation Trust Fund was being misused. And also, I'm sure you may have heard, Illinois, like several other states, is cash-strapped. And the legislature realized we were wasting millions and millions and millions of dollars prosecuting capital cases when here in Illinois we have the, you know, very strict alternative for virtually all murder cases of natural life without parole. However, if you listen to the debates in our House and our Senate, while the cost was mentioned, the debate was on a much higher level. It was on a moral level. It was on a practical level. It really makes for very, very interesting reading.
And speaking of that, Charles, is this report available to the general public? I'd love to read it.
Yeah, actually, the final report of the Death Penalty Legislative Study Committee is online. And I don't have the exact address, but if you Google, you'll probably be able to find it under Illinois Death Penalty Reform Study Commission.
Great. And we'll put a link to that on our website. How many people were on death row in Illinois?
After Governor Ryan cleared out death row, since 2003, Illinois put 17 men on death row. Two of those committed suicide, which left us with 15 men on death row at the time that Governor Quinn signed the abolition bill and also granted sentence commutation to all 15. He commuted their death sentences to life without parole. Actually, for all practical purposes, since Governor Ryan cleared out death row, Illinois' death penalty system really was about 80% abolished in the fact that before Governor Ryan acted in 2003, we used to send 12 to 15 people a year to death row. Since then, it's only been two or three. We've seen that as the problems with the death penalty have been exposed, as the arbitrariness, as the racism, as the mistakes have gone into our public's consciousness, juries have been rejecting the death penalty for the most part in Illinois. So the abolition bill really was just the final nail in the coffin, if you'll excuse that analogy.
Charles, Michael Smith here. I understand that there are still some 35 states in America that retain the death penalty. Talk about that. What can we do about that?
Well, it's true. I think Illinois has now become the 16th state actually to abolish, following on the heels of New Mexico, New Jersey, and New York in the last few years, and also the District of Columbia doesn't have it. The federal government and the military do have it. However, if you take a close look, there are a lot of states that have the death penalty that simply don't use it or use it very rarely. The states that use the death penalty most, the death belt in this country is in the South and Texas, and actually is probably the best evidence that what the death penalty is just a legacy of slavery in this country. I don't know what will happen in states like Texas or Florida or Virginia that use it a lot, but I think what's happened in New Jersey, New Mexico, and now Illinois is definitely going to have a ripple effect across the country. I just read an editorial from the Salt Lake Tribune in Utah, which is calling for abolition of the death penalty in Utah.
Wow. We should call it the Joe Hill bill.
Of course, the three states you mentioned, Texas, Florida, and Virginia, were all slave states. Mm-hmm. So
that's right. And most executions occur in former slave states. And one obvious flaw, if you will, in our death penalty process here in the United States, both north, south, east, and west, studies have shown that the death penalty is much more likely to be inflicted in a case if the victim is white, and the odds go up even further if the defendant is black or Hispanic. So there is a huge component of racism in our death penalty process, and I think it just reflects the fact that unfortunately, still in our culture, the life of a white person is valued more highly than the life of a person of color.
Racism, particularly, but also I understand that they've never executed a rich white man, have they?
Not to my knowledge, no.
You were a public defender defending capital cases. What are you going to do now?
I just picked up my next case. It's a shoplifting appeal. I'm taking it just as seriously on behalf of my client, but you know, the downside, if there is one, is that there are a number of people in the defense bar who are going to lose their jobs. But, you know, we were trying to make the best of it. Obviously, this is it's very gratifying to get rid of this barbaric practice, and people will move on to other challenges.
How long did you do death penalty appeals for?
I started in 1980.
And how many cases did you have, and how did those go? Did you ever have any clients executed, I guess, is the bottom question.
I've represented 35 men and women who were sentenced to death. I do the direct appeals for the most part. I've had one client executed. I've had one client go home. And the rest, whether I won or lost the case, ended up having their sentences commuted either by Governor Ryan or Governor Quinn. But I'll tell you, the one client I had executed back in 1997, who I started actually representing in 1981, so we developed a relationship over the decades, and that is an experience I don't wish on anyone. Camus wrote in Reflections on the Guillotine how the state actually is the cold-blooded killer, how the state is the body that tells the person you're going to die in a year or 2 years or 3 years, and then cold-bloodedly carries it out. Obviously, people on death row, most of them are guilty, although there are still obviously a number of innocent people on death row, and the people on death row, some of them have committed horrific crimes, but we don't think the state should have the right to take their lives.
Charles, give us an update on the status of the chemical that is used in the first part of lethal injections, of which we have a short supply in this country.
Yeah, I think it's even worse than a short supply. I think it's non-existent. And as you may have read, states are trying to figure out how to get it. They've asked the Justice Department to see if they can get some of it. And I think some states have actually made illegal purchases of the drug. This switch from electrocution to lethal injection was a total ruse. It was an effort to make executions more acceptable, to make them appear more humane and painless, when in fact there are instances of people dying horrible, tortured deaths because the chemicals weren't used in the right way. There's a hang-up in a number of states. I believe Ohio can't carry out executions. I think California is hung up because they haven't switched over. Some states are now using just one drug, a massive overdose of a barbiturate. When we were first looking at the lethal injection process here in Illinois, one ironic thing we found was that there were page after page of guidelines and protocols on on the humane slaughter of animals in Illinois, and there was virtually nothing on the slaughter of human beings by execution. No safeguards whatsoever. As a matter of fact, Illinois purchased its lethal injection machine back in the 80s from a guy named Fred Leuchter, who you may be aware was one of these Holocaust revisionists who was sent to jail for pretending to be a licensed engineer when he wasn't. So the whole history of the death penalty is sordid in so many ways.
Let me ask a little bit about the next stage, because as you said, these sentences were commuted, and then people are given life without parole.
Right.
You know, of course, that issue has been in front of the Supreme Court, at least for juveniles, with at least a relatively good decision for part of it. What do you think about that and the idea that people are there without parole?
Obviously, judges, I think, should be given some discretion. In Illinois, some murders, the mandatory minimum is natural life. For other murders, people can be sentenced anywhere from 20 to 80 years in the penitentiary. Obviously, judges have to have flexibility because all cases are different. There's no one-size-fits-all. Life without parole is very draconian. It means there's no prospects whatsoever for rehabilitation, and it may be appropriate in some cases, but certainly not all murder cases. And unfortunately, in some states, the movement for abolition of the death penalty is also accompanied by the passage of more draconian sentences, non-capital sentences.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way you can make the argument, I guess, that no death penalty, but we'll give you this.
But it turns out that the United States, relative to all the other developed countries in the world, has the most punitive of criminal systems, so that the sentences, from what I understand, in this country
are punitive, and there are obviously more people imprisoned. The prison industrial complex has really expanded here over the last couple decades. Obviously, the war on drugs has a lot to do with it. There are so many people who are incarcerated in our country who really should be sent to diversionary programs or rehabilitation, and that's a whole other story. That's another problem that needs to be tackled.
It's a great moment for you, for Illinois, and particularly for, of course, those people on death row. I mean, it's really, really exciting. I mean, the United States is a bit late. I remember, I tell the story, in 1956, I got off a plane in London, and the headlines of all the paper were the effect of House of Commons abolishes death penalty. So that's only, what, 44, 55 years ago. They were doing it in England and, of course, throughout Europe, and we're finally getting it here. And one by one, I guess we're going to take the states down on it.
Well, they abolished slavery first, too.
Right. And actually, this editorial in the Salt Lake Tribune, the first sentence is, "The slow march of human civilization took a significant step forward last week when Governor Pat Quinn signed a bill ending the death penalty in Illinois." And I think that's what it is. It's the evolving standard of decency, as the United States Supreme Court calls it.
That's great.
Exactly.
Well, congratulations,
Charles,
on your work.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Charles.
Right.
State public defender and death penalty appeal lawyer, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Environmental community groups from New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania have banded together to try and protect what is known as the Marcellus Shale Watershed from natural gas drilling and hydraulic fracturing. Generally, it is now known as fracking. It's a method by which natural gas is taken from underground using huge amounts of water, which is filled with chemicals. What comes up is not just natural gas, but water filled with toxins. Water that ruins the watershed, water that seeps into the aquifers, and water the disposal of which is unregulated by any federal agency. 90% of New York City's drinking water comes from where Halliburton wants to continue drilling in the Marcellus Shale for natural gas. There's been a six-month moratorium. It comes to the end in June. And advocates for fracking, unfortunately, are pushing and pushing and pushing. The environmental groups and others who are against it are fighting back tooth and nail. Today we will have a discussion about fracking and what it means to you, not just here in the East, where it spreads across many states, but it's also going on in other parts of the country, in Texas and Colorado, where gas extraction companies are using fracking as a method to get natural gas, dangerous to us all. Today we're joined by Tracy Carluccio, Deputy Director with the Delaware Riverkeeper and an expert on fracking. Tracy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Tracy, we've been reading a lot, not just a little, but a lot about fracking in the last few weeks. There was the movie Gasland, and of course now there's been this incredibly long series in the New York Times about fracking. It's bringing a lot of a public attention to it. I know you've been on it for a while. You're with Delaware Riverkeeper. Can you just sort of bring us up to date? Where are we? I mean, I know New York State has a moratorium, et cetera. What's your work and what's going on right now?
Well, here in the Delaware River watershed, my organization, Delaware Riverkeeper Network, and other organizations have been working for the last few years to try to keep gas drilling from moving ahead. And right now, there is a moratorium in place in the Delaware River watershed on gas drilling. It took about a year and a half to get that into place, but it was instituted last year in the spring, and it will remain in place while natural gas development regulations are developed by the agency that oversees the watershed, which is the Delaware River Basin Commission.
Is the position of the Delaware watershed or your group that there should just be no fracking, or is there a way to actually regulate it? Obviously, it could be made better than it is, but is there any way to really make it safe?
Well, I think it's very clear because of all of the information that's been coming out across the gas-bearing states, and particularly in Pennsylvania in the last year, where gas drilling is just running wild and violations and pollution incidences are out of control. In the Marcellus Shale fairway, that gas drilling is not safe. And we believe that a plain analysis of the facts proves that it is not safe and that regulatory measures that are in place now are certainly not doing their job. I think, you know, the question of whether or not fracking should move ahead at all is a question that we can all intellectually debate. The bottom line is we're facing an industry that wants to move ahead. And the industry is very strong. They're in international concerns in many instances. They're backed by the government in many ways. They enjoy subsidies and exemptions from every major federal environmental regulation. And this industry is going to fight like heck to move ahead and drill every place that gas can be gotten. So I think while we can debate whether or not it's good, and we certainly agree, the risks to human health, to the environment, far outweigh the benefits that are even touted by the industry. But I think in terms of how we go about making sure that these damaging practices do not ruin every place they go is a question that we need to address through the hard work of scientific analysis, technical study, and the debate around regulations.
Tracy, a lot of our listeners may not be from New York, and I just want to get a geographical sense of what we're talking about. You're the Delaware Riverkeepers, and there's a river that comes, you'll have to tell us, and it goes through a couple of states, but you're saying tell us what that is, and there's one consortium, that sort of agency that runs what might happen here. So just give us some geographical placement and where the Marcellus Shale is and what that is.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. I think it's really important. The Delaware River watershed has its origins in the Catskills region of New York State. And the east and west branches come together in Hancock, New York. And then the Delaware River flows past New York State, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, 330 miles from its origins in Hancock to the Atlantic Ocean. And this watershed is about 13,000 square miles and includes these four states and is overseen by an agency that was born out of water wars back in the 1950s. All the states were suing each other about who would get the water for development in their particular locations. And as a result, in 1961, there was a Supreme Court decree and a compact, and President Kennedy signed the document that began the Delaware River Basin Commission. There are other commissions that are based on compacts throughout the United States as well. But this area is very important in terms of water supply. And if you look at rivers across the United States that supply water, many times they supply the water for the people who live in that watershed, and in some instances the waters are shunted off to other areas. That's what's happened in the Delaware River watershed. As a result of this compact, a large percentage of the river was granted to New York City, and the headwaters of the Delaware every day lose a large amount of their waters to serve the people of New York City. So on any given day, between 7 and 9 million people in New York City, even though they don't live in the watershed, drink the water from the Delaware River. And the good quality of that water is well documented through the taste test from the tap. But the result of that compact and the decisions that were made in order to divide this river up amongst the states and make peace has led to development of regulations over the decades since the formation of the commission. So there has been many significant actions federally and in a regional level that have laid out how the Delaware River Basin Commission, which is this interstate agency made up of the four states and a representative of the federal government. The federal government is represented by the Army Corps of Engineers. How this agency has moved ahead to make decisions about the water resources of the basin. But the bottom line is that they are required to make their decisions not based on economics, not based on development of business, but based on the protection of the water resources of the Delaware River Basin. And as a result of that, these regulations and various federal acts have laid down a groundwork, the first one being the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. The Delaware was one of the very first rivers to be included in the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, and the Upper and Middle Delaware was designated by Congress in the late 70s, and as a result, in 1990, the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, my organization, petitioned the Delaware River Basin Commission to put in place special regulations that are based on the Clean Water Act's provision for outstanding natural resource waters. And that Special Protection Waters Program was adopted at that time, and the Upper and Middle Delaware were classified as Special Protection Waters. In 2000, the Lower Delaware, under the leadership of Congressman Holt of New Jersey, was designated as Wild and Scenic as well, and we filed a petition.
Isn't it true that the drilling moratorium ends this June, and what's going to happen then?
The drilling moratorium you're referring to, Heidi, is a moratorium that's attached to New York State. And there was an executive order that was passed under Governor Patterson. It was renewed by the new Governor Cuomo. And that moratorium was based actually on legislative action that had happened earlier. But that moratorium is tied to a late June time frame when there is supposed to be a new draft of the draft supplemental generic environmental impact statement for high-volume hydraulic fracturing that has been drafted by the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation.
They're putting benzene down in those wells. They're releasing radioactive waste. The water treatment plants can't get the radioactivity out of the water. They're putting into our drinking water. It seems to me generally that there's an epidemic of cancer going on because of the environmental situation, and this is only going to contribute to it. And the big money behind gas drilling, you know, like Halliburton, is going to push it through, and that's what I'm afraid of. Should I be afraid?
Of course. I think that everybody should be afraid. I think the practices that are being used by the industry are extraordinary, and they're fraught with risk. The fact is that these practices, which require the injection of hazardous chemicals into the ground in order to crack open the rock and release the gas, are intrinsically polluting. And there's no way out of that. The question about how to stop this is really tied, however, to doing the appropriate scientific analysis free from bias, as it has been biased in the past, particularly under the Bush administration, which gave federal exemptions to the gas industry to move ahead without following basic environmental laws such as the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. All of that needs to be undone. It needs to be undone through scientific analysis that will then hold up to the challenges that undoubtedly the natural gas industry will bring to overturn it. The moratorium that's in place in New York may extend beyond June, just so you know, because there's going to be a new iteration of this EIS issued by New York, and then there will be a round of public comments, and that will all take time. Whether or not the governor will extend the moratorium in tandem with that is a question that needs to be addressed by the public.
What do we do? How can we tell them?
Well, you have to go to Albany, and there are plans for a new lobby days in Albany amongst the environmental coalitions that are working on this issue. But registering directly with the governor's office is the most direct way to do this, because it is through an executive order that this moratorium is in place. Also, the legislature of New York did pass a moratorium. Now, it was fairly weak because it would have ended even sooner in May. But now the issues that are being exposed through the New York Times, and as more pollution incidences happen day in and day out in Pennsylvania, where gas drilling is going wild, I think the evidence is in that even just from a viewpoint of safety and preventing any further disasters from happening, we need to have a complete stop to this activity, and not just in places where it isn't happening now, such as New York and the Delaware River watershed, but throughout the gas-bearing states.
Tracy, it seems that this movement has become just that, a really widespread people's movement of individuals who are concerned about how their homes and property and safety will be affected. Would you say that it is due to this people's movement that the positive aspects have occurred in this field?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If it wasn't for people speaking up, and people from the grassroots level to the town hall level to organizations that are engaged like mine, Delaware Riverkeeper Network, and others, without that bottom-up movement, that cry for action on the part of government regulators, the industry would be moving ahead exactly as they plan, which is to turn our landscapes into industrial landscapes. That's what they've done everywhere they've gone. And the bottom line is they want to do it as cheaply as they can. We saw with the BP oil disaster what that means. Well, you don't even have the equipment in place in order to operate the way you're supposed to be operating. And we have that situation going on right now on land with gas development.
Well said, Tracy Carluccio from Delaware Riverkeeper. Thank you very much for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Michael and Heidi and Micah.
Thanks, Tracy.
Bye-bye.
Late last month, a busload of farm workers from Florida joined members of the New York City Community Farm Worker Alliance at Trader Joe's Upper West Side store. Men and women who pick tomatoes under very harsh conditions demand to be treated more humanely and with improved farm labor wages. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers is a community-based farm worker organization headquartered in Immokalee, Florida, with over 4,000 members. It seeks modern working conditions for farm workers and promotes their fair treatment in accordance with national and international human rights standards. The Coalition's campaign for fair food has won unprecedented support for fundamental farm labor reforms from retail food industry leaders. The campaign for fair food taps the unique powers of all the elements of our country's food industry, of consumers, of food retailers, of growers, and of farm workers. Our own Michael Ratner was at the demonstration. We go now to hear some of the interviews. Let's have a listen.
Greg Asman with the Coalition of Market Workers.
What store are we in front of?
In front of Trader Joe's, actually.
And on Broadway in New York at 72nd Street.
That's right.
1 o'clock on a, what day? Monday.
Monday, yeah.
What are we doing here?
Well, Trader Joe's is one of many supermarkets that still haven't stepped up to what is called the fair food principles of how to source your tomatoes from Florida in an ethical way. And fair, you know, Trader Joe's is a company that sort of markets itself as an ethical place to buy produce, place to buy other groceries. And in fact, here's an opportunity for them to do that, to meet the highest ethical standards out there in the industry, and they're not doing it.
And you are with a group of people called what, the Coalition for Immokalee Workers?
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers, yeah.
And what is that?
Well, we're a farm worker organization from Florida. The Immokalee is a town in southwest Florida that actually is the place where New Yorkers get their tomatoes 9 months of the year. I don't know if you remember The Harvest of Shame, but it was a documentary by Edward R. Murrow in 1960. It was a famous documentary filmed in Immokalee. And conditions haven't changed much since then. And the problem is that for years it's been in the shadows and nobody really knew about it. And our campaign has been to try to bring light to those conditions and to say that the companies that have bought the produce picked in Immokalee are the ones that have been profiting from those conditions all these years. And not just profiting, but actually helping to create the exploitation through their volume purchasing power. And so that's what, you know, we're trying to go back up the supply chain and say, you know, this is where the opportunity stands to be able to change conditions that have existed for years that have been a shame for all of Florida.
Now, we understand that some supermarkets have agreed. I think you're talking about a penny a pound and some work conditions. But for some reason, Trader Joe's hasn't. Why?
It's impossible to understand, frankly. And actually, you know, every time a corporation, that we address a corporation, it's really difficult to understand at the beginning why they take the position they do. And every time we've addressed a corporation, they eventually change. So we're sure that Trader Joe's will change too, ultimately. But, you know, here's the thing. Trader Joe's sells a lot of fair trade products, right? I have to think that there's no way that they would sell a fair trade product and not pay the fair trade premium that actually makes the conditions better behind that product. But in this case, that's exactly what they're trying to do. They're trying to say that they're buying from the growers we're working with and saying that's enough for us to buy from the growers without paying the fair food premium that makes the improved conditions possible in Florida. So what they're doing is essentially it's the opposite of ethical. They're saying they're buying from the ethical growers, but without contributing to the process, without contributing to the program. So they're not doing their part. It's a free rider. That's
so we're talking about how much, a penny a pound? Is that the number we hear?
It's a penny a pound. And a penny a pound would almost double wages for farm workers
no,
at the bottom of the...
Really?
Yeah.
What does a farm worker at the bottom make?
Well, according to the Department of Labor, between $10,000 and $12,000 a year.
Wow. And they survive on that somehow?
Survive is a relative term. You know, survive means having your kids go to the fields on the weekends or taking them out of school to go to the fields. Survive means having to live in a trailer with 12 other guys, meaning sleeping on the floor or sharing a bed with another guy or having a shower after 11 other guys have showered, having to cook your meals on a stove after everybody else has cooked. That's surviving. No air conditioning after coming home from work in the fields all day. That's surviving, but that's how people get by because the wages are too small.
Now, I know you want to get back to the demonstration. I have one more question. How did you get up here, and where are you coming from, and where are you going?
Well, there's been 60 of us in a caravan, 65 of us in a caravan coming up from Immokalee, and we just came back from Boston, where we had a 900-person march on Stop and Shop, which was an incredibly successful event. Family-friendly, happy, joyous event, but also really clear that this is not going away. And Stop and Shop, like Trader Joe's, has to step up to the plate because the ethical standards in the tomato fields are changing. And it's time for the supermarkets to get behind it, too.
Well, thank you very much, Greg.
Thank you very much, man.
So, Lupe, we're standing out in front of Trader Joe's at a demonstration of the Immokalee workers. What are we doing here in the middle of Broadway, in the middle of the day?
What are we doing? Well, we're asking Trader Joe's, we're demanding Trader Joe's to end their silence, signing the agreements with the CIW, Coalition of Immokalee Workers. We've been in protest with them and trying to have dialogue with Trader Joe's for the past 2 years, and then haven't came in terms with the agreements. And all we're asking is for a penny more per pound, farm workers for a living wage, at least would up them $17,000. Right now, their regular wages are $10,000. Also, not only will they
regular
be getting...
Regular wages are $10,000 for an entire year?
Yes, for an entire year. And that doesn't include also paid overtime, no benefits, no code of conduct. So we're asking Trader Joe's to just come to sign the agreements for a penny more so farm workers can earn $17,000, at least $17,000 a year, and also have a voice in their workplace.
And where are the farms?
Where are the farms? They're usually located in Immokalee, Florida, and all throughout Florida.
They sell tomatoes everywhere, right?
They have tomatoes everywhere, but in Immokalee, Florida, they have the longest growing tomato season. So about in the wintertime, 90% of the tomatoes come from Immokalee, Florida.
And other supermarkets and other groups have signed with Immokalee workers, but Trader Joe's has not. Is that right?
Trader Joe's hasn't. For example, a few corporations, you know, that came to the agreements are Whole Foods, Burger King, Subway, McDonald's, and the list goes on.
Okay, now Lupe, what's your role with Immokalee workers?
What's my role? I'm a big ally. I'm also part of the Community Farm Worker Alliance here in New York City. We have a website too, and you can check out our blog if you Google Community Farm Worker Alliance. And we have a blog, we have a website, you can check us out. You can help doing outreach and also become a strong ally here in New York City.
Right. Well, thank you very much,
thank
Lupe.
You. Thank you. Take care.
Why are you here?
Estamos aquí porque estamos pidiendo que esta corporación haga lo correcto como están haciendo otras.
We're here asking this corporation to do the same as others have and do the right thing.
And what is doing the right thing?
¿Qué está haciendo lo correcto?
Que pague un centavo más por libra de tomate que compran en la Florida.
To pay one penny more for a pound for to all tomatoes picked in Florida.
And what kind of work do you do?
¿Qué tipo de trabajo usted hace?
Trabajamos en el campo y en la Florida, más que todo, el 90% de tomate que viene a todos los Estados Unidos es de la Florida.
I work in the fields in Florida, and from Florida, 90% of our tomatoes this time of year come.
And how much are you asking that they pay you more?
¿Cuánto más quiere que las corporaciones lo pagan?
Pues estamos pidiendo un centavo más por libra de tomate. El trabajador gana 45, 50 centavos por cubeta de tomate. Y ahora, con las corporaciones que ya tenemos acuerdo, están pagando un centavo más por libra, les aumentó a 75 centavos la cubeta.
Normally, we're paid 45 cents per bucket we pick. So we're asking corporations to pay one penny more per pound of tomatoes picked, which would increase wages almost to double. ¿Por qué estamos en frente de Trader Joe's en particular?
Porque esta corporación son las que empujan al ranchero que les vende el tomate barato, no pagan más. Ahora estamos enfocados a esta corporación porque así es como logramos que el trabajador tenga un aumento.
We're here because these corporations like Trader Joe's have all the power over the growers because they're the major purchasers of tomatoes in the U.S.
Is there anything else you want to say?
¿Hay algo más que quiere decir?
Pues estamos invitando a todos los consumidores para que rancheros, trabajadores, consumidores, tomemos responsabilidad de esto que estamos haciendo. Nuestro programa se llama Por Comida Justa. Queremos cosechar una cosecha con dignidad, no una cosecha de vergüenza.
We're asking also for consumers to take responsibility in this matter and participate in the Fair Food Coalition, where they purchase tomatoes that are paying the one penny more per pound.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Muchas gracias.
Okay, thank you much.
Dear listeners, this is Michael Ratner from Law and Disorder. We're happy to tell you that our beloved co-host, Heidi Boghossian, will be honored on April 8th by the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. This is a public event, and we urge you to come.
There'll be cocktails, entrees, hors d'oeuvres, live entertainment, dancing. It's going to be held at the Angel Oren Sanz Arts Foundation at 172 Norfolk Street. And if you get a pencil, go to www.nlgnyc.org. Hope to see you there.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Let's go!